Okay, so this is the third lecture on Carter's Magic Toy Shop. The ending of last week's lecture went like this, and these are the last two paragraphs from my lecture from last week. And I said that Wolf, de Beauvoir, and Carter agree that women's lives are governed by a paradox of their situation. And the paradox is that they belong at one and the same time to the male world and to a sphere in which that world is challenged. They are shut up in their world, they're surrounded by the other, they can settle down nowhere in peace. I was quoting de Beauvoir when I read that. And the last thing I said was that in 1967, which is the date when this novel was published, this precisely is what the situation that Carter depicts, of women being torn between two worlds, a situation where women exist in a liminal space, where the male world is all-powerful, but where there is room for change. Now, what characteristics that change will take will be explored in this week's lecture on Cixous and Irigaray. So here's the plan for today. Sorry, that was the quote. Here's the plan for today. I'm going to emphasize at the start of the lecture the context in which Cixous and Irigaray are writing. It's very important to understand what happens after 1967 that gives rise to this radical form of feminism. Where does it come from? Why is it so radical? And then I'm going to discuss very briefly Cixous and Irigaray. I think you might have found these readings a little bit convoluted, rather difficult to read. Is that fair description? Good. That's good. They're doing this on purpose. And of course, you know by now, we don't expect you to understand everything in this reading. The idea is to use them as tools. So that's precisely what I'm going to do. I'm going to mention Geoffrey Weeks very slightly. This is the third reading that was assigned for today, but just sort of to show you how much we can broaden what Cixous and Irigaray are talking about. Okay, so I want to start with context. 1968 is the year that follows the publication of Magic Toy Shop. It's an incredibly important year for politics, for gender, for race issues, class issues. And I've only selected, because I found on YouTube videos of these riots, I've only selected to show you very brief scenes from London, Paris, and California. But actually, there were riots in Japan, riots in Prague, riots all over the world. And I'm going to talk about them. But I just wanted to show you like a minute from each one of these, just so you get a picture of the kind of revolution that suddenly erupted in 1968. Okay, I've got here. Okay, this is 1968 in London. Of course, these were race riots in California, and a few months later, Martin Luther King himself would be assassinated, and his assassination would lead to a new wave of rioting in Washington. So what I tried to show you at the start of this lecture, really, is to give you a context for the reading that we're doing here. This is reading that is coming at a very crucial point in history. Of course, these essays were not written in 1968, but they are post-1968. These are 1970s texts. They are post-1968, and 1968 is very important because it is the year where students were rioting. They were angry because they did not have equal access to education in France. The British were angry because of Vietnam. The Americans were angry because of Vietnam. But the Americans were also angry because of race issues. So post-1968, there was the possibility of rioting, of saying no, of walking down the street, of fighting hard to make a difference, to make things better. And it is post-1968 that Cixous and Irigaray are writing. And it's very important to always position them at that very important moment in history. And I'll show you in a moment where both of them say, this is the right time for us to write this. they recognize that it's a moment of transition. Both of them say, this is the right time for us to raise these issues. Okay, I'm not going to give you too much history, but I think that gives you an idea about the context. Yeah, shall I move on from context? It's okay? Okay, good. So, the reading for this week, then, comes from two French critics, Cixous and Irigaray. And I'm going to discuss them simultaneously. I'm not going to treat them separately, because their ideas are similar on many points. I will then offer you a critique and assessment of their essays. But before I do so, I want to draw your attention to two critical terms. Equality feminism and difference feminism. And as I discuss these two terms, I am almost reading word for word the definition provided by Alice Stone. That's why I've cited her down here. Equality feminists share the belief that women should be able to participate equally in society and should have equal access to the benefits and positions that society makes available. Yeah, the key term there is equal access, equality. Some equality feminists want women to be able to participate equally in existing social institutions. Other equality feminists think that society needs to be radically transformed before equality can become possible. Yeah? Difference feminists start from different sets of concerns. They believe that women have distinctive values or perspectives, the worth and importance of which have not yet been recognized. Okay. Difference feminists reject the view that women, above all, need equal access to the public sphere as it is presently arranged. They don't accept that the most important thing is to offer women equal access to the current state of the public sphere. Presently, the public sphere is shaped by masculine values. But these are not the only legitimate values. So difference feminists like Cixous and Irigaray emphasize the need to discover difference. What is it that makes women different? And then ask questions, does the current setup satisfy the needs of difference? Last week, I mentioned briefly de Beauvoir's famous statement, one is not born a woman, one becomes it. And I said that this statement represents her understanding of femininity as based not on essence, but on experience. Do you remember? It's not about essence, it's about experience. That's why you become it. Well, this statement is a good starting point for understanding Cixous. Consider this. One is not born a woman, one becomes it through experience. That's a valid paraphrase of de Beauvoir's statement. Well, what if the experience that one has of the world around her is predicated upon binary opposites that place woman as the passive, as the inferior, as the silent other? What kind of woman does one become in that case? This is the first question that is posed by Cixous in the extract that we're reading from Sortie. She calls binary opposites dual hierarchized oppositions, because she maintains that when culture juxtaposes father, mother, head, heart, and day, night, for example, there's an implicit privileging of the one over the other. There's a hierarchy which is built into these oppositions, and this hierarchy has historical and cultural origins. So she's saying the hierarchy doesn't exist there because women are essentially inferior. She's saying that culture has created this hierarchy. The way in which our culture reads hierarchized oppositions privileges the man. Not necessarily the male. It privileges the position of masculinity over the woman. So if one becomes it, and it is the position of woman, then one becomes passive, inferior, silent other. Does that make sense? And so Cixous maintains that the consequences of the subordination of the feminine is the exclusion of the woman from participation in history and culture, because history and culture are set up so as to exclude that feminine position. This is what Cixous means when she says that in the extreme, the world of being, and they put being in quotation marks, the whole existence, the world of being, can function to the exclusion of the mother. That just existing in this world can only happen through the exclusion of the mother, because that is how culture has set up these dichotomies, these binaries. There is no need for the mother, provided that the father can fill in for this role. That's what Cixous says. So in these binary oppositions that inform our thinking, either woman is passive or she doesn't exist. That's the state of things. That's how culture is set up, according to Cixous. And here, Cixous invokes the example of literary history, which, of course, is a concern that coincides with Virginia Woolf's, yeah, literary history, where she notes that the subordination of the feminine, she notes the subordination of the feminine to the masculine order appears to be the condition of the functioning of the machine. This is similar, too, to what de Beauvoir says. If you rock the boat, if you shake the structures, then everything else collapses. And again, here I must emphasize that the terms masculine and feminine are used by Cixous not necessarily to refer to men and women. These are subject positions that members of either gender could occupy. And Cixous clarifies this very important point when she explains that she's using qualifiers of sexual difference. For there are men who do not repress their femininity, women who more or less inscribe their masculinity. The difference is not distributed according to socially determined sexes. This is a really crucial point in this theory. The argument is that society subordinates the feminine and privileges the masculine. And we can note how the concerns in Carter's novel anticipate Cixous' argument. And I'm going to do that now to show you how we can read Carter's novels anticipating these concerns. I'm sure that you have noticed that mothers are physically absent in this novel, yeah? Melanie's mother is written out of the narrative within the first few pages. Mrs. Rundle, the substitute mother figure, is separated from the children soon after. Aunt Margaret's mother is dead, and Aunt Margaret, who has been married to Uncle Philip for some time, is childless. Mothers are absent. But there is, I would argue, not an empty space, but an abyss. And I'm borrowing this word from Cixous. There is an abyss where the mother should be. So let's look at the representation of the mother. We learn about the mother through Melanie's memory of her. Melanie remembers her mother exactly as Sixu would expect her to, through the lens of history and culture. History as in the past, and culture as in the mother, the role that the mother occupies in that family. The absence of the mother invites Melanie to try and reconstruct her mother's history by trying to access her mother's body. This is the scene from the novel that I'm interested in now. Melanie tried to imagine her parents making love. This is maybe page 10 or 15 at the very beginning of the novel. She tried to imagine their embraces in this bed, but her mother always seemed to be wearing her black going-to-town suit. Her mother, in particular, was an emphatically clothed woman. I like that word, emphatically clothed. You know, no bit of flesh was showing. Clothed all over, never without stockings, whatever the weather, always gloved and hatted, ready for some outing. Her mother must have been born dressed, perhaps in an elegant, well-fitting cowl, selected from a feature in a glossy magazine. What the well-dressed embryo is wearing this year? Okay, I have so much to say about this. You can see in this passage that the mother's body is inaccessible to Melanie. The body, the skin, is inaccessible. Her mother seems to have been born dressed. And because Melanie can only see her mother in her social context, she's always seen like she's dressed to go into town. She doesn't know her mother's body. She knows the clothed, socially conditioned body. But there's also a hint in this quotation as to how we could read the female body. Look at this quote down here. What the well-dressed embryo is wearing this year. Does this statement make sense? It seems to come out of the blue. Why is there mention of embryos? Well, Carter here is using cowl, this word, well-fitting cowl, in its two meanings. Okay, and I've got the two meanings here. You know I'm going to post the PowerPoint online, so don't feel obliged to write everything. A cowl, the first meaning of it, is a covering of network for the head that is worn by women. It's like a net that women wear over their head. But also, a cowl is a part of the amnion, one of the membranes enveloping the fetus, which sometimes is round the head of a child at birth. It's also called a veil. So can you see the link to the embryo? And she's saying, let's go back to the quote. Her mother must have been born dressed. Look at the wording. She was born dressed, perhaps in an elegant, well-fitting cowl. She always has this net over her head, but it seems like she also still has this embryonic look about her. What the well-dressed embryo is wearing this year, because her mother draws her sense of fashion from the glossy magazines. So you see the twinning of the embryonic mother and the social mother. Okay, there's a lot of irony in this statement. Melanie's mother is enveloped like a fetus in her socially conditioned role. Now Melanie turns... After this scene where she tries to imagine her mum and dad in bed and she's unable to access her body, Melanie turns her attention to her mother's wedding photograph. And here, too, she notices clothing. She notices that on her wedding day, her mother had an epiphany of clothing. That's like the strangest statement I've read, an epiphany of clothing. Do you remember that scene where she says she had all the colors, she was flamboyant, she had feathers everywhere, some of them, you know, got in the way and she couldn't see her father's face even in the photograph, and of course he was wearing tweed. as usual. Her father in that photo was always seemed to be clothed as well. In this wedding photo, Melanie sees her mum in a different light, because in this wedding photo, mother, father, and relatives are posing together. And this is where she notices Uncle Philip. And what Melanie notices is that, unlike the rest, Uncle Philip did not smile to the camera. He might have strayed into the picture from another group. His expression was quite blank, too blank even. It is significant that Uncle Philip seemed to come from another group. He is the antithesis in this photo. He is the binary opposite in the photograph. And in this case, the father and his family, because you know Uncle Philip is the only surviving relative on the mother's side. The father, the family, the mother seem to be on one side and Uncle Philip on the other. The photo seems to suggest two groups, those who are smiling and those whose faces are blank. Well, if we keep this photo in our mind, then my reading of Uncle Philip from last week makes even more sense. Remember where I read Uncle Philip's relationship to Melanie's father, where he positions him in a feminine position. He sees him as an unmasculine, as not a man. Okay. So he occupies the masculine sphere, and mum and dad occupy the feminine, silent sphere, because in fact they are silent in this narrative. But in this lecture, I'm more interested in the silent mother, so I'm going to stick with the reading of the silent mother. Cixous tells us that the bodily encounter with the mother, which is a term, of course, that I'm borrowing from Irigaray's text as well, allows sons and daughters to develop their sexualities. That's why it's important. The girl who aims to differentiate herself from her mother, and the boy aims, well, he doesn't aim, the boy just desires the mother's body. But if the mother's body is inaccessible, then Cixous would argue that the young girl, Melanie, lacks access to sexual difference. She lacks access to feminine sexual pleasure. The suppression of the mother leads the daughter to seek an understanding of her sexuality in the modes available to her in society. And these models, the binaries, Cixous would argue, are phallocentric. The Mrs. Rundles of the world are archetypes of femininity. They are, in Cixous' words, coded mannequins. Did you notice that term at the end of the extract we were reading? They are coded mannequins who have only ever experienced sexuality from one perspective. Those are the Mrs. Rundles of the world. And Irigaray would agree with this reading, that lack of access to the mother's body leads women to not have access to a different form of sexuality, a different understanding of their sexual potential. Irigaray calls the relationship with the mother a dark continent. She says it remains in the shadows of our culture. Irigaray sees woman as occupying two spaces, one that satisfies the social and material roles that are prescribed to her. For example, the first role that woman occupies is she has children, she cares for others. Irigaray uses the word nurse. And she's a reproducer of labor power. So woman satisfies a material and social function. And Irigaray is fine with that. But there's also another role for woman to occupy. And that is the role of the imaginary and the symbolic, which is about the mother's relationship with her son or her daughter. That social role that woman occupies remains unsymbolized, unacknowledged in culture. But it nonetheless exists. And different feminists are trying to get us to acknowledge there's a different dimension of existing as a woman that is not yet, in 1975, not yet acknowledged in social speech, in discourse, in social representation of femininity. Irigaray, like Cixous, finds that the social and material roles of women are easily recognizable, but the imaginary and symbolic roles are repressed. Both critics agree that they are writing at a time in which, at a time in history, which is a transitional time. It's a period when this question of domination by fathers can no longer be avoided, Irigaray says. The social order, our culture, wanted this way. The mother must remain forbidden, excluded. The father forbids the bodily encounter with the mother, she says. So how do we then access the imaginary and the symbolic? If they're forbidden, if they're repressed, how do we get to them? How do we know that they're there? Well, Irigaray says that we have to go back to the first bodily encounter with the mother. I know this is terribly theoretical, but I'm going to make sense of it in just a moment, so hang in there. She says, the first bodily encounter with the mother in intrauterine life, if you can remember that far back, in the relationship with the placenta, the first house to surround us, whose halo we carry with us everywhere, like some child's security blanket. I know it's poetic, because they're both poets, and in French, they write beautiful rhyming prose. It's just brilliant to read. And I know it looks theoretical. It's nonetheless a work of art, but there you go. Well, going back, let me explain it. Going back to Melanie's attempts to conjure up the mother's body, the statement that I've just read to you from that paragraph, her mother must have been born dressed, perhaps in an elegant, well-fitting cowl, takes on a deeper meaning. That's what that statement means, that by looking at the photograph, Melanie cannot have access to her mother's body. The mother is not here. The mother, well, hasn't died yet at this stage. The mother is represented in a photograph, in her wedding dress, clothed. How do you access the mother's body in its absence? According to Irigaray, you access it by trying to have an encounter with that very first experience of the mother's body. And I think this is why that call, that reference of the embryo is there. Melanie is trying to access not the mother's role as it is represented in the wedding photo, you know, a wife, a future mother, a nurse, sort of a lady of social standing. But she's trying to access the well-fitting cowl, the part of the body that is shared exclusively by the mother and child. Think now of Aunt Margaret. She and her brothers are motherless. She cares for her brothers in the house of her husband, Uncle Philip. They are a family. He can be seen as the father figure, and she's his wife. She's supposed to occupy this mother figure. The father forbids the bodily encounter with the mother. So just in brackets, I know this is going to be dodgy now, because obviously it's problematic, but the way I'm reading the bodily encounter with the mother and child here, I'm doing this in the same logic as the bodily encounter. So I'm reading mother and child The same logic as the bodily encounter between Margaret, Francie, and Finn, because I'm reading it symbolically. I am not condoning some practices that took place in the book. I'm not going there, basically. Okay, this is symbolic. Okay. Margaret's body occupies that mother's space. And in that respect, she must remain forbidden. She must remain excluded. Now, Irigaray says that when the father forbids the mother her generative powers because he wants to be the sole creator, this is what Irigaray says, he wants to be the sole creator. By doing this, by forbidding her her generative powers, he superimposes upon her body a set of signs, a set of symbols, which rob her of her identity. Isn't that obvious? Okay. Yes? No speech? Okay, I'll say more. In Carter's novel, Uncle Philip sees himself as the only creator. He is the artist. He actually physically creates things. But he sees himself as the father. Aunt Margaret has no creative space to express herself, except for playing music secretly with her brothers. Uncle Philip's oppression has superimposed on her body, from her wedding night, a set of signs. When you look at Aunt Margaret, well, when Melanie looks at her, she notices her frailty. Yeah? Aunt Margaret's body tells her story. She notices her frailty, and she notices the fact that she cannot speak. So this oppression has superimposed on her body a set of signs which rob her of her identity. So in order for Aunt Margaret to transcend this oppressive situation of being de-subjectivized, this is a term from Irigaray, I didn't make it up, de-subjectivized, in order to do that, the rule of the father must be challenged. Irigaray contends that the murder of the father must take place. And murder here is not literal murder, although I know that in this novel, you know, the fire would kill Uncle Philip. But what Irigaray means by murder of the father, murder here signifies a desire to take his place, a rival and competitive desire, but a desire to do away with the one who artificially cut the link with the mother in order to take over the creative power, this is a quote, yeah? The creative power of all worlds, especially the female world. In this quote, Irigaray imagines the woman committing the murder of the father to take his place. Take his place and claim a role for herself, which has been oppressed and repressed. So Irigaray imagines the woman committing the murder of the father and taking over the creative power of the female world. She calls this a rebirth. But Carter's novel anticipates, in many ways, this reading. In Carter's novel, the position of woman is occupied by Margaret and her brothers. They are all three marginalized, and they occupy that position of weakness, that position of silence. So the murder of the father begins with Francie's desire to take his place. Do you remember that he sat in Uncle Philip's seat at the table near the end of the novel? Do you remember that scene? He comes in and he sits in his chair. And everybody's appalled, saying, why are you sitting there? Especially Aunt Margaret, why are you sitting there? Then he goes off and wears one of Uncle Philip's shirts. Do you remember that he made the decision not to open the shop? And then Aunt Margaret says, oh, yes. Oh, let us not open the shop. Let us defy the father's orders. Francie's desire for Margaret rivals and is a competitive desire to Uncle Philip's. Francie and Finn burn the house and decide to literally kill Uncle Philip because he cut the link with the mother. He interrupts the bodily encounter with the mother. So why is this an important reading of the novel? Well, it's important for two reasons. Firstly, this reading of the novel offers an insight into Melanie's attitude towards sexuality and illustrates her lack of access to what Irigaray calls a genealogy of women. By not being able to think of herself as part of a female genealogy, as having, if you like, I'm going to use the word matriarchal, she doesn't. By not reading herself in terms of a matriarchal history, I am the daughter of so-and-so, who is the daughter of so-and-so, and these are the characteristics of femininity that I've inherited. By showing that Melanie lacks access to a genealogy of women, I think that Carter, like Irigaray, advocates the practice of locating ourselves, and this is for men and women, of locating ourselves within a genealogy of women, so as, in her words, to conquer and keep our identity. So regardless of our gender, if we only read ourselves in terms of our patriarchal history, Irigaray would say we are robbing ourselves from an opportunity to see ourselves also as falling within a matriarchal history. And secondly, this reading shows Aunt Margaret's silent body symbolically representing the oppressed and silent mother's body, which must be accessed and liberated. Okay, I'm going to finish soon. I just want to offer you a critique and a possibility of reading Sixteen Irigaray in a different way. At this point in the lecture, I want to take a moment to think critically of the theories I've just presented. I want to ask, what are the implications of these theories? I realize that Sixteen and Irigaray are more theoretical than pragmatic. So I ask myself, how can these theories be useful to me as a literary critic? The question that both theorists pose seems to revolve around the body. Can the body be a source of discourse? A discourse that is not necessarily mediated by the laws of patriarchal society. Conventional narrative techniques, conventional ways of writing, including grammar, syntax, imply the unified viewpoint and mastery of outer reality. When we are taught how to write grammar, full sentences, capital letter, full stop, capitalized proper nouns, all of these rules imply a unified viewpoint that we're all going to agree on the grammar. And mastery of our outer reality. And so these theories that we read today advocate a transformation of the literary modes and language on the one hand, and the broadening of the context of women's discourses on the other. I would be very comfortable reading Sixteen Irigaray and thinking about race riots, and thinking about the position of women as occupied by black being oppressed by white. I'd be very comfortable reading these texts as texts that are encouraging you to think that the law of the father, whatever that father is, a colonial father, a white father, whatever that position is, that law of the father has got to be questioned. And it is our job to uncover the silent other, the matriarchal hidden substratum. And that's really why I think these are valuable theories. They also open up our thinking about sexuality as a continuum, which is precisely what Weeks is talking about, and that's what I'm going to discuss next week when we do a butler. Yeah? Good? Useful? Happy?